That's probably why they did it.
All right, so good morning. We're going to begin. Definitely feel free to keep on getting coffee, doing other important things that are required to thaw out on a day like this. We're up to Rambam's interpretation of the Torah. Rambam obviously plays a significant role in this course, just being one of the most important Jewish thinkers who ever lived, and also paved the way for many different avenues of thought. We've already been through dogma, Jewish beliefs, different ways of relating to people who either doubt, question, never learned, or aren't sure, or reject Jewish beliefs. We're now up to another area where I believe that a solid grounding in the background of this debate, the more debates you understand, the easier it is to create unity among Jews, even if they totally disagree with each other. That's the philosophy of the whole course. And when it comes to Rambam and biblical interpretation, you really get a sense of where we can go with this in today's discourse, and something that I found particularly helpful in dealing with all kinds of people from all different kinds of backgrounds. One thing that Rambam, you need to know about him, is that he's one of the very few great Jewish thinkers ever, particularly in the medieval period, who never wrote a Bible commentary. Right? That seems to have been deliberate. He was quite the expert, like with everything else, but he seems to have gone out of his way not to write a verse-by-verse systematic biblical commentary, which is what everybody else did. You know, Ramban, the great mystic, he wrote a systematic commentary on the Torah, and in it he included all of his mystical teachings and rabbinic teachings and outlook and halachic discourse. That was the normal mode. You just go verse by verse by verse. The way people make money nowadays, if they want to do no real research at all, is you just make compilations of Rambam's teachings verse by verse. All you have to do is go through Rambam, and in the olden days you would have used index cards. Now you could just computerize the whole thing. And people just publish collections of Rambam's writings on verse by verse of the Torah. But he never wrote that commentary. It's really just a compilation. So he wrote systematic Jewish law, Jewish philosophy, and that leaves it to the rest of us to figure out what his points of view were on biblical thought. Now, there are two important principles that Rambam left us. We've already discussed how, because he was a 12th century thinker, a lot of what he considered science, and certainly a lot of what he considered philosophy, is either wrong or significantly outdated. Right? In other words, we're not interested in how he dealt with particular problems in terms of how we think about things. We're interested in the methodology. Rambam's methodology is as relevant today as it was in the 12th century, even though, of course, today science is very different, philosophy is very different, and even what we consider reasonable is very different. The two most important contributions, if I had to summarize everything that underlines the bedrock of Rambam's philosophy, is that Tanakh always is reasonable. That was point number one. We discussed this a little bit last time, but today it's going to be much more on the front burner. But Rambam believed that all of Tanakh must be reasonable, and what that means is it must be compatible with science, and it must be compatible with reason. Since God is the author of all of that, God is the eminently reasonable being in the cosmos, God invented science, he's the one who made the cosmos, and God revealed the Torah, they must be in sync. So what happens if we read the Torah and it says that the world was created in 6 days, and then all of a sudden we think that the world is 15 billion years old, or the cosmos at least is 15 billion years old? Rambam would say the reason why there are any discrepancies at all is because we don't understand something. So if science can be verified, let's say we're absolutely proven, or at least reasonably proven, that the world is a lot more than 5,775 years old, well, then we must reinterpret the Torah. And that goes in the realm of what today you and I call science. That was a good example. There are many. And it also goes with the realm of reason. The most prominent example of that being, Rambam considered it not only utterly unreasonable, but absolutely non-Jewish to believe that God has any body parts. So even though there are plenty and plenty of biblical verses, including in the Torah, God's fingers, nostrils, hands, arms, feet, you name it. You know, the classic bearded guy I don't know about the sandals, but the old bearded man sitting in a throne. All of these images appear in the Bible. They're not just made up by the far side, right? Although Gary Larson, I liked reading his philosophy of why he always makes God that very old, long-bearded, you know, he wanted to keep it as reverent as possible, given that whenever you write anything about religion and humor, somebody might really threaten you. So he was concerned about that. So he kept it as respectful as possible. But all the same, you have all these images. Rambam says you must not take those literally, but rather they're figurative. It's a way of communicating divine ideas to regular people like us. Okay, so that's one category where Rambam made a big splash. He wasn't the inventor of that idea, but he probably pushed the limits in many areas much, much, much more than his predecessors. He was always happy when earlier great rabbis thought the same thing as he did. Everybody likes a precedent. But if there were no real precedent, as long as he felt that he was on solid footing with science and or reason, which to him were part of the same spectrum, he was good with that. That was important point number one. Important point number two is that the Torah is infinite and eternal. That is a basic premise of Judaism. That God revealed the Torah not just to Moshe and his generation, but he revealed it for all Jews of all time. It was always intended as an eternal covenant for the people of Israel. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about that. But what Rambam paid attention to is granting that point, it still was given at a particular time, with a particular sociological and historical setting, with particular neighbors that the people of Israel had then. Rambam said we can't ignore the historical setting of the Torah. He was very big on that. He felt that both narratives and laws, you need to understand context. Not that you always understand the full context. Even today, scholars with so much more archaeological findings than what Rambam had at his disposal, didn't matter. We don't know the context 100%, but his point of view is it's obligatory to understand what we can and to realize that the Torah and the rest of the Bible, they were revealed to real people at a real time. And to ignore that, to think that it was just given in a bubble that transcends history, is simply incorrect. And that's a very important point also. In other words, that's the historical dimension of the Torah. And it certainly comes with a lot of implications as well. Now you should know that every single point that Rambam made on both of those areas, some people embraced him with both arms, some people probably embraced him more with one arm, and some people wanted to beat him up. Some people were outraged that Rambam would change the meaning of the Torah in order to fit science or reason. And some people were outraged at how much he tried to contextualize the Torah. They said, what are you talking about? God is eternal and the Torah is infinite. And certainly once you start quoting mystical teachings that the Torah predates the world, the whole idea of Torah predating the world is that it didn't need history to be given. The Torah was there first. So who cares about historical context from that point of view? So all of these became enormous debates and continue to be enormous debates in every arena. So I want to start with a couple of abstract ideas and move them to more and more tangible ideas over the course of today, just to give you a sense of the breadth of which Rambam had a systematic program to reinterpret the Torah in sync with his conception of science and reason. And then, of course, our idea of science and reason is different now, but once again, just understand his methodology. If you open up the whole Tanakh, who gets prophecy? You tell me. If you just read through the narratives that we've been reading, who gets God or an angel to appear to him and to her? What sorts of people? Huh? Noah gets prophecy. Who else? Okay, carry on. Moshe Rabbeinu gets prophecy. Okay. Prophets get prophecy. Good. Anyone else? Does anybody else experience angels and or God's voice directly? Huh?
Lavan.
Oh, wait, he doesn't quite fit the bill of the other ones. Bilam gets prophecy. I'm not sure that Sarah ever gets prophecy, but okay. It's a debatable thing. If she was part of that vision, then yeah, then she got it also. That's true. Okay, good. If you open up, so if you had to develop a systematic theology based on who gets angelic encounters or divine encounters, what do we conclude? Biblically speaking, there's one answer to common. Hagar sees an angel with Ishmael. You know, you have the great prophets, you have the less great prophets, you have all the prophetic schools, obviously. Other great figures, but you also have people who we would think of as much lesser figures. Hagar, Lavan, Lot. Right, they all get, just in the last couple of weeks in the Torah, we've seen all kinds of angelic encounters with lesser type of figures.
Abraham.
Huh?
Abraham.
Abraham, certainly. Yeah. The great figures, yeah. Yes. Right.
Is prophecy and encounter with an angel the same? Because I always thought prophecy is more of like a message that's some kind of portentous, but Hagar getting a message from an angel look over there or something like that?
Well, it's more than look over there. It's that you will be blessed with a son and he will be the founder of a great nation. There is a message. It's more than just here, have a drink. Correct. The angel did that also. But the point is that there's a prophetic message. The biblical, if you had to make a systematic theology based on the biblical evidence, you could see it, you could summarize it very easily. God reveals himself to anybody he needs to reveal himself to. Doesn't matter if you're a great individual or a sort of great individual or not such a great individual. Right? That's the way that the biblical record works. Obviously, most revelation comes to the greatest people, Abraham, Moshe, the whole books of the prophets, sure. But officially, just based on all the evidence, if you had to make one sentence to develop a systematic theology based on the biblical evidence, anybody can get prophecy if God wants that person to have prophecy, which seems reasonable enough. If God wishes to reveal himself, he should be able to pick anybody he wants. It's not so hard to figure that one out. Well, that's good for us. One example within the biblical record, which is very curious in this regard, is source number one. Do you all have source sheets, by the way? I have plenty, so never be shy about that. The prophet Amos, who lived in the 8th century BCE, was threatened, as usual, at being a prophet with great integrity, so the people of the north did not like him very much. So he got into hot water with somebody named Amatziah, who was the priest of the Beit El shrine, which was an illegal shrine, the chief shrine of the northern kingdom, actually, at that time. So Amatziah said, get out of town. So Amos wasn't interested in that. So he said, Amos answered Amatziah, I am not a prophet, and I am not a prophet's disciple. I am a cattle breeder and a tender of sycamore figs. But the Lord took me away from following the flock. And the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. He said, look, I never went to prophet school. I never trained as a prophet. I'm not a professional prophet. I have a real job, right? I'm a cattle herder. I work on fig trees. That's how I earn my living. Why am I doing this? Not because I enjoy it, but because God made me go. The simple reading of this is that here was a simple man who wasn't involved in the schools of prophecy of the 8th century BCE. And God said, okay, I need you. He got the call. He walked up north and yelled at the whole northern kingdom. Fat lot of good that did. The north ignored him as usual. But he left unbelievable messages for us. The book of Amos is fantastic. The simple reading of this story is that he was a simple man and God needed somebody to go on a mission. All right, that's the biblical record. So poor Rambam, in his Guide to the Perplexed, when he discusses prophecy, he realizes exactly what I just told you. It's pretty obvious even. There's no other way to think about it. God reveals himself to anybody that God wants to reveal himself to. That simple. That's what the Torah and what the whole Bible seems to say. But then Rambam quotes Aristotle's view on prophecy. And Aristotle's view on prophecy is that only the elite philosopher can get prophecy. In fact, according to Aristotle, it's part of nature. If you are an elite philosopher and you reflect on God all the time and you lead an ethical lifestyle, you necessarily get prophecy. So in his Guide for the Perplexed, Rambam quotes the biblical view, which he considers the view of the Jewish masses, which include most great rabbis, by the way, Khuzari, Rav Sadia Gaon, because it's obvious what the biblical record has to say about this. You don't have to be a great scholar. It's very clear that it all fits together that way. So he calls that the view of the masses. Then he quotes Aristotle. And then he says, what's the Jewish view? Meaning what's Rambam's view, but for him those are one and the same. What's the Jewish view of prophecy? He says, basically it's like Aristotle. You have to be a supremely elite individual. Only a great religious philosopher king type can get prophecy. But the difference between Rambam and Aristotle is that God still has to choose you as a prophet. In other words, if you're not philosophical elite material, who's obsessed with God, absorbed with God, always philosophizing about God, and living a very righteous lifestyle, according to Aristotle, then you get prophecy. According to Rambam, you're qualified to get prophecy, but God still has to choose you. There's still a miraculous nature of it. So what is Rambam doing? He's trying very, very hard to bridge what the Tanakh clearly teaches and what he would like Tanakh to teach, right? He wants Tanakh to teach that only the great elite people can do it. So it's easy when you're dealing with Abraham or Moshe or the prophets. It's harder once you deal with people like Hagar and Lot and other figures, even Amos, who is a prophet, but he sounds very plain. So Abarbanel, who loves Rambam more than anybody, he thinks Rambam is the most important rabbinic thinker who ever lived, but he doesn't always agree with him. He said, look, it's very obvious, and by the way, Abarbanel is correct, that Rambam was extremely influenced by Greek philosophy and distorted the biblical message. The biblical message is God chooses whoever he wants as prophet. And he quotes Amos to prove his point. Abarbanel says, Amos is a shoe-in winner. Here's somebody who is definitely a prophet, but who describes himself as having been a simple man who has a real job, and God made him go. He didn't train as a philosopher. He didn't train as a prophet. He was a working man, and a great working man at that. But God needed him to go on a mission. So Abarbanel says, here's one example of many, where Rambam was trying so hard to combine Torah and his conception of philosophy that it ended up missing what the Torah itself is teaching. And that's, of course, the hazard of trying to reconcile two viewpoints, or Aristotle and Torah. For Rambam, they had to go hand in hand. But for, as far as Abarbanel is concerned, who understood Aristotle very well, they don't fully go hand in hand. By the way, poor Rambam. The reason why Rambam, Heschel writes about this, it's very interesting. Rambam must have wondered why Rambam never became a prophet. Right? Seriously. Rambam was an incredibly righteous Jewish philosopher. He had all the qualifications. So Rambam actually answers it with his own Guide for the Perplexed. He said, God still has to make the decision to choose you. But according to Aristotle, Rambam would have been a prophet.
Did he not believe, like many other thinkers, that that was in another time period?
That's another way of dealing with it. But since there's no categorical principle of that, you're right. The standard view and the traditional view is that prophecy stopped with Malachi. But it's not 100% clear that that's a doctrine. It's certainly the way that we think about things. Rambam, no, but Rambam was this ideal religious philosopher who led, he was exactly Aristotle's, well, I think he was, and I think he thought he was, and so Rambam's own philosophical code helps explain why somebody like Rambam never attained prophecy, Right, so, but he would say that God still has to make the choice. Even if he's worthy, it's not natural. That's the way Rambam understood prophecy. But here's one example, which again is in the abstract for us, but it's a very important one. Let's move it a little bit more down. For example, Rambam says in source number 2, it's in his treatise on resurrection, Rambam states his principle of how he reads Tanakh, which is a very important principle. He says, I believe every possible happening that is supported by a prophetic statement and do not strip it of its plain meaning. I fall back on interpreting a statement only when its literal sense is impossible, like the corporeality of God. The possible, however, remains as stated. So Rambam's point of view is, always take Bible literally unless it contradicts reason. I always assume this is historical, exactly as told, unless it contradicts reason, which includes science. Then you need to reinterpret. But of course, Rambam, he picks a very easy example of God's corporeality, which, you know, most rabbinic thinkers accepted, that is, it's that God does not have a body. But there are many, many, many other examples that Rambam also considered absolutely illogical, and therefore you cannot take them literally. Example, it's kind of an interesting one. The prophet Hosea, or Hosea, in source number 3, who was a contemporary of Amos, actually, also in the 8th century northern kingdom of Israel, the very beginning of his book, when the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go get yourself a wife of whoredom and children of whoredom, for the land will stray from following the Lord. So he went and married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. She conceived and bore him a son, .. The whole first chapter of Hosea is God, that God orders the prophet, the saintly individual, who has this, you know, prehistory of an unbelievable relationship with God. He says, okay, I want you to go marry a wife of whoredom, which all medieval commentators understood to mean a prostitute, right? And nowadays we're more likely to say that whether or not, whatever her history was before, the whole point is that she's going to cheat on the marriage. That's the point of the prophecy. Just like Israel and God are married, so to speak, in a covenant, and Israel has gone unfaithful by worshiping idols, so too this woman is going to go straying on Hosea. That's the parable, and that's what it means. That's certainly what it's talking about. Well, Rambam's eyes bugged out very far when he read this passage. It seems very clear that if we took a time machine back and went to Hosea's Shabbat table after chapter 1, they ended up having three children together, each with a symbolic name. So if we went and took a time machine back and sat around Hosea's Shabbat table, it's very clear that how many people would be around the table right now? The answer, of course, is six, right? Hosea, Gomer, the three children, and you. No, you just showed up in the time machine. You're at the table. So those are the six people that would be around. Historically speaking, if we took a time machine back, that's what we would see. And that's fine, right? That's the way. And we understand that why would God create such a shocking message to make a prophet marry either a prostitute or a woman who's going to cheat on him? Because it's a symbol for the people of Israel. It was supposed to be a shocking visual aid in the 8th century to shake people up into doing repentance. Yeah, even without YouTube. I'm sure this one got around as fast as ancient people could make it go around, because this was scandalous.
Went viral.
Right? Very good. So Rambam reads this story, and what's his paradox? To him, he has a certain concept of God, and he has a certain concept of what prophets are. So he writes in source number 4, the Guide for the Perplexed also, "Therefore the multitude think," again, he doesn't have a high attitude of the multitude, as you know, "the multitude think that these actions, transportations, questions, and answers occurred, all of them, in a state in which they could have been perceived by the senses, not in a vision of prophecy." Meaning those silly masses take the story literally. They think that Hosea really married this woman and really had the three children. That's what the masses think. Then he says, "God is too exalted than that he should turn his prophets into a laughingstock and mockery for fools by ordering them to commit acts of disobedience." Rambam says, my God doesn't do that kind of thing. My God doesn't tell a saintly prophet to go marry a prostitute just to make a visual aid. Forget about it. My God doesn't do that, and God would never do this to the prophets. In the same way when he says, "like as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot," which is another interesting visual aid. Poor Isaiah was told to walk around naked for 3 years. So even if you grant, it doesn't mean 24/7 for 3 years running, but even if it means over a 3-year period, he sometimes has to go out in public naked in order to demonstrate. There the visual aid was done to tell the people of Israel, you're going to be dragged naked off into exile. That was the visual aid in that case. Rambam says that's impossible. It cannot be that God did this. And only the masses, only those foolish masses, read the story and take it literally. But any sophisticated thinker would realize God would never do this. The position is similar with regard to the words addressed to Hosea, "take unto you a wife of harlotry and children of harlotry." All of this story concerning the birth of the children and having been named so happened in its entirety in a vision of prophecy. Meaning if we took a time machine back, what would we find? We would find Hosea lying in his bed experiencing prophecy. We never ever would have met this Gomer, and these three children did not exist. They never existed in a physical waking state. These children were not there. It's all in Hosea's prophetic experience. Why is Rambam not willing to accept the story literally? Because it's impossible. It cannot be that God would command a prophet to do this. So Rambam considers that it's not just God's hand. For him, this is just as unreasonable. And he says you have to be a fool to think that this story took place literally. So one such fool is Rambam's great friend and supporter, Abarbanel. Abarbanel took incredible umbrage at this passage.
But tell me, in the Bible itself, in Genesis, Keturah, entirely different.
Different ballgame.
Same sort of, but she was mentioned, and the children were mentioned, everything.
Yeah.
And this is God saying,
right,
not a prophet.
Right, but Keturah was a nice woman, so far as we know. Abraham married a nice person. Hosea is being told to marry a low person. And so Rambam says that can't be. There's no way that this happened in real life. So Abarbanel is outraged at this. Just so you understand Abarbanel's love of Rambam, by the way, besides that when he was still in Portugal and in Spain, he used to give classes on two things, in Bible and Rambam, and filled the house. He was the best teacher in the country. He was one of the best teachers who ever lived. People used to say about Abarbanel's classes on Rambam, you know, everybody else who gives classes, it's like copper, but Abarbanel, pure gold. That was the compliment that people gave to Abarbanel. They thought nobody understood Rambam like Abarbanel. Abarbanel, when he was an old man, we actually have a letter that he wrote to one of his friends. And he said, you know, in the good old days when I was young and peppy, I used to read everything I can get my hands on, which is clear. You read his writings. He read everything he can get his hands on. But now that I'm old, you know, life is short. I have to make sure to focus just on the best of the best. So he focuses on only two books. Only two books that he read as an old man over and over and over again. One was the Bible, and the other was Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed. He considered them the two most important works ever written. So Abarbanel had a great deal of respect, to put it mildly, for Rambam, but he did not always agree. Here's a case where he really did not agree. Source number 5. One must be extremely astonished at these learned authors, referring to Ibn Ezra and Rambam. How could they advance this kind of sweeping principle in prophetic narrative? How can they say that it bothers me that God commanded a prophet that, oh, so then it just happened in a vision? How could they do that? If the text testifies that the action occurred, we have no right to depart from its plain sense, lest we interpret the verses incorrectly. In other words,
That's the critical part.
Yeah. Indeed, he goes on. Again, remember, he's talking about his all-time favorite rabbi. Indeed, it is an infidelity and a grave sin, zima vavon plili, to contradict the plain sense of the verses. And if this is what we do to them, this disease, calling it tzara'at, which is what people mistranslate as leprosy, but it's that terrible disease, that, you know, the religious disease of the Bible, will spread over all verses and reveal interpretations that contradict their veracity. Abarbanel was fuming that two of the greatest people who ever lived, Ibn Ezra and Rambam, thought that these stories were prophetic visions and not literal. He said, once you say, this doesn't make sense to me, I'm going to say that it didn't happen, well, then that opens up the door to everything, right? Elsewhere, Abarbanel freaks out. Some people were quoting Rambam to say that the Akedah never happened. Because after all, Rambam believed that no person, even prophets, encounters angels while in a waking state. And we all know that the way that the Akedah stopped is an angel showed up. So people were quoting Rambam to say, oh, you see, if an angel is showing up in the story, that means that the whole story was in Abraham's prophecy. It never happened. Well, Rambam didn't speak about that directly, but people in Abarbanel's time were quoting Rambam to say, look, based on Rambam's principles, so Abarbanel, to put it mildly, blows his gut and lets them have it. He says, outrage, this is not what Rambam thought at all, and they're wrong, and he said much stronger words than wrong. He really goes for it. He's outraged at the concept. He said that according to Rambam, the story happened. If we took a time machine back, we would see most of it, and then he went into prophecy where an angel encountered it, within Rambam's view. Take that or leave that. I'm not interested right now in what's Rambam's view on the Akedah, just because it's not clear. I'm interested in the battle that's going on. Rambam says, whenever something doesn't make sense, you can reinterpret it. Mm-hmm. And Abarbanel said, no. If you can't take anything non-literally just because it doesn't make sense to you. Right? In other words, that's what's at stake. In other words, with the body part, he agreed. But how far does that go according to Rambam? Far. And according to Abarbanel, much less far. There are certain things that Rambam wasn't sure, so he preferred a non-literal reading, but was much less emphatic against the literal reading. For example, the prophet Isaiah says that in the future, the wolf will lie with the lamb, right? Which makes for an excellent name for a steakhouse, but in the meantime, the wolf will lie with the lamb. So Rambam didn't think that nature would change. When the Mashiach comes, as far as he is concerned, nature will go on as usual, which means that wolf will still be gobbling up as many lambs as you'll let it eat. So what does it mean that the wolf will lie next to the lamb? It means that vicious nations will be able to get along with nice nations. It's an allegory for people. Others took it literally, that the whole point is that in the Messianic era, nature will change, and in fact, the carnivores will stop being carnivores and be perfectly fine with alfalfa sprouts. But that's the way some take it. Now, of course, in this particular case, Rambam doesn't have a dogma underlying it. His point is, look, let's say Mashiach comes and wolves prefer the salad bar, right? Okay, Rambam will be okay with that. So how does Rambam express this point? It says in source number 7, and also in his treatise on resurrection, you must realize that I am not at all positive that all the promises and the like of them are metaphorical. He says, look, when it comes to Mashiach, whatever goes, goes. He'll be happy with Mashiach here. And if in fact carnivores stop being carnivores, cool. But he says, if you ask me as an interpreter, what do I think is more likely, I don't think nature is going to change. So he's not always dogmatic about it. When it comes to Hosea and a prostitute or Isaiah walking around naked, as far as he's concerned, that's impossible. It cannot be literal. When it comes to things like prophetic messianic visions about wolves dwelling with lambs, okay, he thinks it's not literal either. But if it's literal, fine, we'll take Mashiach that way also, and the carnivores won't be carnivores anymore. So that's one huge track of how Rambam works. And the debates were always vigorous. Just to give one last example of this, then we'll move over to the context issue. Just a couple of weeks ago in the parashat, my bar mitzvah parashat, talks about how three angelic visitors come, and Abraham and Sarah serve them lunch, and they eat, and they have this wonderful feast and bread and all these other things. And then two of the angels go over to Sodom, and they rescue Lot and Mrs. Lot, although Mrs. Lot makes that terrible mistake of looking back, and you know what happened to her and the daughters. And it all seems like that happened. If we took a time machine back, we would see all kinds of amazing stuff. We'd see three angelic visitors dressed up as people coming and having lunch. We'd see two of them coming and then smiting a whole town with blindness and later on smiting the town, right? We'd see all kinds of interesting things and rescuing Lot. According to Rambam, all of that happened in a vision because you can't encounter angels in a waking state, and these are angels. This all happened in Abraham's vision. Right? If we took a time machine back, we would not see Sarah baking bread because Sarah was simply part of the vision.
But weren't those angels couched in the form of actual
people? So they weren't quite angels as angels. As far as Rambam is concerned, this all happened in a prophetic vision. And the point is that they looked like people in Abraham's vision.
But,
huh? Well, he's the likely candidate in all of this. And it even says, the Torah says that God appeared to Abraham. So we might have thought God appeared to Abraham by having these angels come to his tent. But the way Rambam reads the story, God appeared to Abraham in prophecy, and all these things that you're about to read happened in prophecy. So in this case, Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, he's the one who goes bananas. He gets furious at Rambam. He says, how can you say that? Why would the Torah talk about how they got butter and they got meat and they made bread? Who cares? If this is all in a vision, just cut to the chase about how God appeared to Abraham in prophecy and said that your wife Sarah will have a son. What's with Sarah's laughing and then the angel criticizing her for that? And then what about the angels that went over to Sodom and destroyed it? All that happened in a vision? So Ramban, the classic way that medieval commentators dealt with stuff like this is they would say, is forbidden to, I'm breaking all of Ramban's dictates right now because I'm quoting Rambam, it's forbidden to think this, it's even forbidden to quote it. Mm-hmm. Now, he thought that this was heresy. He thought that this is beyond the pale of belief, of Jewish belief.
Sodom was destroyed, right?
Yeah, Sodom is not there anymore.
Not just in the dream.
Correct. That's, Rambam has a lot of questions against him. And Ramban says, you can't tell me that all of this happened in a prophetic dream. It seems very clear that all these things really, really happened in a waking state. And he actually goes out of his way to explain what Rebecca said about how it can be that angels can show up in human form. So he gives a more mystical type of explanation, which is probably what you need to explain metaphysical beings suddenly showing up at your doorstep and actually eating cake or bread or meat or whatever they're busy eating. As far as Ramban was concerned, this is beyond the pale of fair Jewish interpretation. We have to accept the Torah as more literal than what Rambam did. So there are big fights about all of these things. That's one category. Moving over to the setting of Tanakh, again, Rambam emphasized very strongly and constantly that even though Torah is eternal, and its laws and narratives have eternal messages, and the laws are always binding, Rambam believed that everything was given in a context. And therefore, certain formulations, certain legal formulations even, were given because the Torah was given thousands of years ago. In principle, had the Torah been revealed to us today, it would not have had the same words, even if it had the same legal principles. That's the theoretical point here. It's theoretical because, of course, it did. One great example of this is that Rambam believed, why do you need all of the sacrifices? Rambam was a philosopher. To him, it's all about philosophy, it's about prayer, it's about meditation, it's about reflection. What do animal sacrifices have to do with that? And by the way, it's about one, traditionally we say there are 613 commandments. And basically 1/6 of those pertain to the building of the tabernacle and later on what became later on the temple. Sacrificial order, the incense, you name it, it was there. A very hefty number of laws pertain to the temple. Rambam says that all of that was given because back in the good old days it was a pagan world. And God needed to wean Israel away from paganism. So if he said, okay, I'm the Lord your God, now we're all going to be religious philosophers, and you tell that to ancient Israelites who have just been slaves in Egypt for centuries, and who are not all great religious philosophers, and are not capable of being great religious philosophers, they'd say, what kind of religion is this? Abstract philosophy? I need animal sacrifices. That's how we serve our God. True. So, all true, sadly. All true and sadly. But Rambam's point is that God, therefore being a brilliant educator that he is, said, I'm going to give these laws of sacrifice, not as the ideal, but rather to wean the people of Israel toward monotheism. Meaning, had the Torah been given in the 21st century, it's at least possible that Rambam might think we'd have other things that would have to wean us against today's problems.
Why would sacrifices mean monotheism?
Sacrifices don't mean monotheism. Sacrifices, pagans practiced sacrifice. Everybody had sacrifice. So Rambam's point is, sacrifice was such a basic part of everybody's religion. If God were to say, I don't want sacrifice in my religion, the Israelites would bring sacrifices because for them, this was religion. So God figured, let's do sacrifice, but let's do it my way. And gradually that will train the people of Israel to fully be monotheists, right? That was the point. It was part of a training process. Now, of course, once you start saying that about laws, that opens up two very dangerous avenues that Rambam got severely attacked for. One was in right away by Ramban. Ramban said, this is a terrible thing. He says in source number 9, behold, these words are worthless. They make a big breach and raise big questions and pollute the table of God. Ramban wasn't interested in Rambam's theory. He thought that this was just objectively outrageous. How dare Rambam come along and say that the Torah's laws are at least in part as a training process? No, that God's laws are eternal, they're ideal. God gave us laws that he thought were the best laws, and therefore sacrifice must be a good thing. It's not that it was good in that context. Right? Rambam really seems to tone down the inherent value of animal sacrifice and focus on the contextual value of it. Ramban says that's an outrage. He really felt that this was a terrible breach, and he attacks him very strongly for that. In the 19th century, there was a different problem. When the Reform movement was being founded, well, everybody likes to view themselves as an heir to Rambam. So they said, look, Rambam's point is these laws were coming to wean us away from paganism. So now in sophisticated 19th century Germany, where everything is right, well, so they thought, we don't need these laws anymore. We're now in a place where we're sophisticated. We don't need animal sacrifices to wean us away. We've been weaned. It's time to move on now. And of course, they didn't just apply it to sacrifice, which anyway is not in practice. They applied it to many laws that we do keep, whether it was kashrut or whether it was Shabbat or whether it's Brit Milah or all of the different laws that we keep. Many members of the nascent reform movement said, well, it's time to get rid of these laws.
They also went on to say that this wasn't necessarily written by God, it was written by man.
That was another trend of the 19th century, which it was all going down at the same time. You're absolutely right. And they went hand in hand to some degree, but part of it was they were invoking Rambam, because of course he doesn't want to use Rambam to prove your point. So Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who was in the front lines battling against this whole trend, he said this is a terrible abuse of Rambam. He didn't think that Rambam made any mistakes by saying what he said, but he was very, very disturbed by the implications of what Rambam might be saying, that laws might be dated based on context. Rambam never said that. In fact, he was worried about people concluding that. But all the same, Rambam's words were significantly abused. Now, Rambam made a sweeping principle about this. He said, any law that you and I can't understand, people like Rabbi Yehuda Levi and the Kuzari, let's start with him, all these laws, like why can't we cook meat and milk together? So many rabbinic thinkers thought the best thing we can hope for, and we talked about this a little bit last time on the other end, the best we can hope for is this is because God wants us to follow his command. We don't need any other reason. God said so. That's what we want to do. And people like Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi considered that to be ideal religion. If we're following God's command, that means we're doing it all right. Rambam said, you've got to be kidding me. God always has a reason. We might not always understand the reason, but God is reasonable. He's not giving us laws just to make us obey him. Every law has a reason and a purpose, and if we could get to the bottom of it, we would be able to figure that out. Rambam was very insistent on this point. He thought it was insane. He called it a sickness to think that God is just going to make commands so that we will be obedient. Right? God is better than that. Rambam's God commands because God is eminently reasonable. And therefore, he was convinced that all laws that you and I don't understand, like why don't we cook meat and milk together? There's no rationale. Does it make us more moral? Maybe, I don't know. But Rambam was convinced that, huh? A kid, yes. So, which has always been understood to be meat and milk, but Rambam, we're gonna get to your point, because that's actually the point. So Rambam says in source number 10, also in the Guide to the Perplexed, if we knew the particulars of those practices and heard details of those opinions, we would become clear regarding the wisdom manifested in the details of the practices prescribed in the commandments concerning the sacrifices and the forms of uncleanness. I'm not italicizing these things, by the way. Shlomo Pines or Pines is italicizing them. They were very into italics 50 years ago when they made translations. So that's what I'm not being italics happy. Not that I couldn't be, but I'm not in this particular case. And other matters whose reason cannot, to my mind, be easily grasped. Let's put this into plain English, right? Plain English is, if we had infinite pagan documents, if we had all the historical background of the surrounding context of the ancient Near Eastern Israelites, meaning the whole ancient Near Eastern context, if we had all their legal codes and all their mythologies, if we had everything, we would understand every single law of the Torah. Even the ones that we don't currently have access to. Why? Because the Torah is battling against paganism, because paganism makes you immoral, and monotheism makes you moral when done right, right? Good monotheism, which is certainly Rambam's monotheism, makes you an incredibly ethical person. So Rambam argues that whenever there are these laws that seem to us like why not cook a kid in its mother's milk, or why not cook meat and milk together, the answer is there must have been some pagan practice that everybody was doing, and God wants to distance us from that practice. That's what he's saying here in plain English.
Question.
Yeah.
Is there any, does he put forth any proof for that?
He has none.
For that?
He has none.
So it's, I mean, as far as we're concerned, then it's just a naked assertion.
Correct. You're absolutely right. What he did have, and that's what he discusses throughout this whole section in the Guide for the Perplexed, is that he had some pagan documents that had practices that resembled some of the things that the Torah outlaws. It doesn't prove everything.
But why do we ascribe so much value to even Kedushah to what he wrote? It's just, you know, I can tell you I saw an elephant fly.
You did?
Right. I know a song about that.
I want to hold on to your point. Let me just finish the sentence, and then we're going to talk about why David's point is exactly the right question. Right? So Rambam was delighted by these pagan documents that he did have, because he said, oh, you see? The Torah outlaws certain things, and I couldn't understand why we are not allowed to do them, and now we see that certain ancient pagans did this stuff. It must be that certain pagans did all of this stuff, which is a grand-scale sweeping assumption, which is exactly David's point. But he says, I for one do not doubt that all this was intended to efface those untrue opinions from the mind and to abolish those useless practices which brought about a waste of lives and vain and futile things. In other words, the point of the Torah is to root out paganism. Okay, that's his assumption. The good example here is cooking a kid in its mother's milk, which is what he discusses in right around this passage that I'm quoting you. He says he's convinced, even though he has nothing in his available documents, that there must have been some pagan practice probably associated with the agricultural cycle, because the Torah often links, don't cook a kid in its mother's milk and bring, you know, this produce to the what became Jerusalem, bring produce. There's very often some element of connection between seething a kid in its mother's milk and agriculture. So Rambam speculates, pure speculation, right? Pure speculation, that there must have been some pagan practice probably involving some fertility slash you know, agricultural holiday, where pagans sacrificed or seethed kids, meaning the goat kind, with pagans you never know, but the goat kind in its mother's milk. And of course he had no document at all. In 1929, just to fast forward a little bit after Rambam's time, in a town called Rosh Shamra, north of Israel, archaeologists discovered a ton of documents and artifacts from some ancient culture, and it's in a language that we call Ugaritic. And so, of course, the scholars moved in, had to decode the language, figure it all out. It's some ancient Semitic language related to Hebrew. You know, it's one of these proto-Hebrew languages. And lo and behold, they found on one of these documents an agricultural pagan festival involving seething a kid in milk. Sorry, it's not its mother's, but in milk. Well, the scholarly establishment went bananas. Like, Rambam's got his document. Here we are. We've saved Rambam. It's like Rambam knew he didn't have all the documents in the world. In fact, he knew he had very few. But he was convinced if you dig deep enough, we'll find this document. So people went bananas. When this was published in the 30s, everybody was so excited that here Rambam finally has his document. And for generation, scholars were all quoting this study, showing that, which by the way, just to keep with David's point, because David's point is really germane to the whole discussion, it doesn't actually prove Rambam's point. Even if there were a pagan holiday involving cooking a kid in its mother's milk, that doesn't mean that that's why the Torah outlaws it. Right? And if you don't find that document, that doesn't mean that it's not down there somewhere underground. Right? Arguments from silence don't prove anything either. But this was exciting because here was concrete evidence, or stone evidence, of what Rambam was speculating. People were so delighted. Finally, here's the bad news, if you think that this is bad news. In the 1970s, some other scholars said, you know, we're all quoting the same study from the 30s. We're quoting one guy. Can somebody please show me that document that everybody keeps quoting? I hate when scholars do that. It ruins everything. And so they checked it out, and lo and behold, you know, where there's supposed to be the word kid, there's actually a hole. The scholar in the 30s was reconstructing the text and thought it must be kid. Why did he think that? Because he knew Rambam. Bummer, right? So there that went. And then, by the way, from the Department of Unbelievable Subspecialties in Scholarship, that I'm so glad that somebody does this, because I probably would not pursue this as a career. Experts in Ugaritic handwriting moved in. How's that for a subspecialty? And they realized that the Ugaritic word for kid actually cannot fit in the hole of that size. That's why you need these people to be there. And so they decided it probably was coriander in milk and not even its mother's milk, and it's all over. So Rambam doesn't have his document anymore, sorry. Since the 70s, he has not had his document. But going back to David's point, which is really, you know, where we're going with all of this, Rambam was setting a principle out. Right? Rambam's principle was the Torah was given both as an eternal document, but also in a particular historical cultural setting. And it's impossible to ignore the historical cultural setting, but at the same time, as Rambam himself warned, and as all his critics felt free to mention all the time, we can't overplay the cultural setting. Right? Sometimes we just don't have enough information, even now in contemporary archaeology, where there's a lot more information available than there was when Rambam was around in the 12th century, which is why Rambam's principles are so helpful. The setting only gets you so far. Whereas Rambam was a little overzealous in trying to assume a few documents can prove theories. Whereas today, hopefully, we're a lot more cautious about what archaeology does and does not prove. What Rambam gives us, and this is why it's so important, just to summarize this point, it reminds us that the Torah, while being eternal, was given in a particular context. And I don't need to tell you, and this is my whole line of work in the Bible field, we have gained so much in the last two centuries, linguistically, historical setting, culturally, just understanding pagan mythologies and what pagans thought. And now we realize how much the Torah really was bashing the pagan world and breaking new ground from within a pagan setting. It's actually incredible. Rambam was right. The principle of what Rambam wanted was right. What Rambam also teaches us is that we need to have a lot more scholarly caution about what we do or do not have. One of Rambam's earlier colleagues, Ibn Ezra, actually had a better approach than Rambam did in terms of how to view his historical setting. Ibn Ezra in the book of Zechariah, which is one of the hardest biblical books, it's really brutally hard. He says, look, he starts off his commentary, and again, one of the greatest commentators who ever lived, he said, man, this book is real hard, which it is. Rashi started his commentary the same way. But then Ibn Ezra adds, he says, you know, if we would find some documents and histories from that period, then we would be like blind men leaning on a wall. That's the image that he uses, meaning it would still be a hard book, but at least we'd have some anchor in history. But now we have nothing to lean on. That scholarly caution is much closer to the mark in terms of contemporary research in the book of Zechariah, where now we have tons of Persian documents and Greek histories of the Persian period. We actually have a lot of information about Persia. And that's exactly what it is. We're like blind people leaning on a wall. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the right setting. Maybe this helps us understand this or that. So to summarize all of this, then we'll take a couple of questions. Why is this shiur so important for creating Jewish unity? We Jews like to argue, and bless us, and that's the way it always was, and that's the way it always should be. We shouldn't all agree. It's not about conformity. The best way to create Jewish unity is to understand this shiur and then take away the venom. Which Rambam's mistake was calling all the Rashis and Kuzaris and Abarbanels of the world idiots. Right? He was hostile to anybody who took certain texts literally. He said, you've got to be a fool to take these things literally. So that was harsh. And then you would have the Kuzaris and Rambans and Abarbanels of the world firing back at Rambam. This is beyond the pale of Jewish teaching, which is also a very harsh accusation. So basically, all Jews are either fools or beyond the pale of belief, depending on which side of the spectrum you're on. The way to bring about Jewish unity is to understand that there's actually a wide diversity of opinions of how much you take literally and how much you don't, and take away the venom. Instead of all the name-calling and the rhetoric, say, look, we're all here to study God's word. We're all here to come together and try to understand what our tradition teaches. Some people might take these stories more literally. Some people might take them less literally. What are the eternal, enduring messages that these stories are coming to teach? Once you're able to understand that the debate is ferocious, well, get away from the ferocity, you actually can bring people together, even if they completely don't read the story the same way. And that's something that I think is all everybody needs to learn this. Whenever I teach this type of thing up at Yeshiva University, that's actually the point that I get to. After watching everybody call each other very sharp names, I just say the best way to get past this is to keep on having exactly the same debates without the name calling, without the venom that each side shows toward the other one. Rebecca? Oh, of course.
Right. So why would he honor that kind of contextual practice, but then not sacrifices or having more than one wife, or many of these other things that are also contextual? How do we know which ones still stand and which ones still
go? Excellent question, and a very important question. Rambam believed very wholeheartedly that all commandments are eternal. All.
Eternal.
I mean, they're all valid. He kept all of them, or whatever ones were possible to keep. I mean, there is no temple, so he couldn't keep the temple laws. But he believed that all of them are eternal. However, in other words, he didn't think that the context would deflate their value. He actually worried that some Jews might read him and use the context to deflate their value. But he still felt that despite that, and he also stressed, we can never fully know why God did something. Human reason still has its limits, and Rambam understood and admitted that he was very humble. He didn't think that he knew God's mind. But what he did believe is that the Torah needs to make sense to us. That he believed unwaveringly. And so if there's just these random laws that he doesn't understand, he says, there has to be something that you and I can understand as intelligent thinking beings. That's what he didn't want to back away from and never did. That's what's important. But he didn't think that the Torah lost relevance because of any context. That's right. That's right. Nothing is ever obsolete of Torah law. Benjamin? Well, the Torah has not won all of its visionary goals yet. We've won some battles. The world is different now from 3,000 something years ago. But we have a long, long, long way to go for our vision to go. Right, so that's exactly Rebecca's question. You're asking the same thing, just from two different sides of the room, and therefore I have to look in a different direction. Once again, just to stress this point, Rambam believed that all 613 mitzvot are eternal. None are time-bound. Everything that's in... They are meant to attack paganism. They're still given in a context. That's what makes sense to Rambam, but there's always more to it than that. In other words, you could never think that we understand the whole reason, and they're applicable anyway. But Rambam I'm just going to repeat the point because it's an important point. Rambam was insistent that the whole Torah must make sense to us. Doesn't mean that we understand the whole Torah, but it must make sense. If it makes no sense, we're doing something wrong. And if we insist that it makes no sense, then we're crazy. And that's... Of course, right, correct. But he had a sense, that was his unwavering belief, that all mitzvot must have some reason that you and I can understand. Yeah, Megan?
I thought that it was an interesting point about the Jews in Germany who wanted to sort of give this up now that the purpose was complete.
Right.
And the fact that the Holocaust happened in Germany, and there were a lot of things to be said for that, I guess, from their point of view, that there were, you know, there was a great civilization and at that time and great universities and things were kind of, I don't know, more genteel than in the past. And the fact that that happened in Germany is almost a, you know, imprimatur for the Torah, because if you have followed these laws, that would not have happened. So there's a clear distinction between people who follow these laws or are moving toward a higher level of spirituality and relationship to God than people who are not, even though it might look like it's working on the other side.
Okay, I'm not in a place to comment on why the Holocaust did or did not happen. That's beyond our knowledge. What we can say is that the 19th century German Jews made a colossal mistake. Just religiously. I'm not going to blame any of world events on that mistake, but it was a colossal mistake in terms of understanding A, the Torah, and B, understanding Rambam's point about the Torah. In other words, they were abusing Rambam. Rambam's whole point is that the laws are eternal no matter what, even if certain educational values have been internalized, you know, between the biblical period and the 19th century. A couple more questions and we'll call it a day, yeah?
This kind of dovetails on what you just said, because I keep, when you talk about taking away the venom, but I also think that it has to be said within a certain frame. For example, with the Reformed Jews in Germany, I think it would be entirely appropriate to kind of say, in a venomless way, this is not at all within a realm of, you know, what the acceptable discourse is, because it's not grounded in the fundamental principles of the discourse. So, you know, there, when we talk about Jewish unity, there are so many camps, and some of them, as you pointed out with your Nechama Leibovitz statement, are just not at all within the camp of, you know, a fair debate, so to speak. So that is what kind of makes it hard to pass that wide tent, because, yes, you know, there are camps that are fundamentally accepting important tenets, and they're disagreeing in a way that's not that's not kind of fair or venomous, so to speak. But then there are many, many camps that are fully without that. And then, you know, it becomes important to also say that there has to be kind of a line or a way to say, you know, this is not...
Yeah, we might, quite obviously, yes, we have a backbone. I mean, the whole point, this goes back to what we had a couple of weeks ago. There's a big difference between using the word heretic and using the word wrong. Right? In other words, to me, those positions are wrong. They're beyond the they are in fact beyond the pale of traditional thought, and it needs to be said that way. It's not an I'm okay, you're okay, everything is okay philosophy. I fully agree. That's why I said to Megan that it's a colossal error. In other words, this was simply a misread of the Torah and of Rambam. The Torah is the important one to misread here. In other words, that's the mistake. That's the fundamental mistake that was made, and we need to be clear on that point. There is no way to be unwavering about that. Yeah.
I would just respond to that by going back to my elephant. You were talking about blind man leaning against the wall and getting a sense. There's obviously the story of all 10 blind people all touching an elephant in a different place, and each coming to a different conclusion. And I think that's more like it. In good faith, everybody's touching an elephant, but some people are coming to one conclusion, others the other. It's not just one man on one wall, it's 10 men.
No, for sure, you're absolutely right. Rebecca's point is that some people aren't even touching the elephant. I think that's the issue. The perspectives.
Who's touching the elephant?
Correct. So that's why traditional Jewish belief backbone is so significant, to understand here's what tradition holds universally. And then outside of that is something else. But then within tradition, all my point is that there's a very wide menu of opinions, and very much often at odds with one another. I think that your elephant analogy is always a good one. On that happy note, wishing you a wonderful week. Looking forward to resuming next week.